I'm delighted to be here at LSE Ideas. It's great to be at a leading foreign policy think tank. As a policymaker, I really value the exchange between academics and policy. And when I was at Yale, I very much valued it too when I was working in the academic sphere. So I'm a huge supporter of what you're doing here and delighted to be here this evening and very much looking forward to the chance to hear what Chris has to say and then pick up some of your questions. So as you were saying, I thought we'd do about 30 minutes from me, and then let's see what that triggers. So I said we'd talk about UK-China, and then we said stocks, Shakespeare and satellites. And what we were trying to do with that title was to pick up the sense of the old and the new in China at the moment, to pick up, I think, the breadth now that is in a diplomatic relationship. If you think back to traditional 19th, early 20th century diplomacy, you're talking very much about government-to-government relations. And I think over the last few decades, we've seen that expand not just into the business sphere, but also cultural people links, all part of a much more complex web of diplomatic relations, which I think is important. I think, too, I wanted to try and give you a sense of the range of UK-China relations now. So we go right back to Shakespeare, and I'll come on to talk a bit more about that and the 400th anniversary, and right, as it were, up when you think about satellites, but also the sense that some of these things aren't quite the same in both places. So we saw a lot of the volatility in the stock exchange earlier this year. And when we talk about stocks in the UK, we talk about something that we know much more about, that runs through the economy in a very different way from the way it runs through in China. So that was part of the brain teaser around the title that we picked. But the challenge I have as ambassador, that my team has across China, and my colleagues in the foreign ministry have, is really to meld all of this into a 21st century diplomatic relationship. And my underlying philosophy is the one I alluded to earlier, which is that we will have a strong bilateral relationship with China if we have one that is essentially triangular in structure. When I talk about this in China, I talk about it as a three-legged pot. You know those Chinese pots with three legs, the ding. But three legs make it very stable. So you have a leg that is government-to-government relations, a leg that is business-to-business relations, and a leg that is people-to-people relations. So that's the sort of relationship that, as ambassador, I am trying to build in the 21st century. And what I thought I'd do this evening is talk in fairly broad terms about the China context that we're working in, because, as Professor Cox said, you've already you already know it anyway, but also you've had some very interesting discussions on that, so I don't want to go into China in great detail. But what I would like to do then is use that as the basis to explore what we're trying to build in what we're calling the golden era of UK-China relations, so what the structure of our foreign policy will be, and when we look back on the golden era, what the key signal achievements will be of that period, and then perhaps we can talk about that and draw out some things from there. So let me first canter through the sort of context of China at the moment, and I want to draw out three themes. The first theme is, and you'll all be very aware of this from your discussions, China is now much more international than it has been in the past. So we have, I think, very clearly abandoned the Deng Xiaoping axiom that we should bide our time and hide our light. Xi Jinping is a much more outward-facing, a much more international president. He's been very clear that China needs to take a role on the international stage, that China's voice should be heard in solving international and global problems. He himself is probably the most travelled Chinese president that we've seen, and he has a very great vision for China's foreign policy, which is probably most easily encapsulated in the One Belt, One Road. We've seen China create international organisations, the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, just last year, and finally have some success in rebalancing their weight in existing ones. So the IMF voting was, of course, rebalanced last year. We've seen China's support for a rules-based international system in many places, but we've also seen this rise of China and the greater internationalisation of China come out and challenge some of the existing order. So we have tensions in the South China Sea, for example. I think that then brings me on to the second sort of context that I wanted to bring out, which is, of course, the economic context. Now, Everyone is talking about economic headwinds these days, from the Chancellor yesterday doing the budget to Premier Li Keqiang at his conference at the end of the Lianghui yesterday. But at the heart of a lot of the discussion about the economy is, of course, what we think about China's economy, because it is so intrinsically linked into the global economy. Now, it is an $11 trillion economy. It's the second biggest economy in the world. It contributed a third of global GDP growth last year. So it is very big, very influential. But it is very true that it is growing more slowly than it has grown in the last 25 years. But we have to be careful with that statistic, because 6.5% growth on an $11 trillion economy gives you about as much as double-digit growth on the sort of economy that we had at the end of the 2000s. But it is growing more slowly, and that has implications for all of us, but it also has implications for China, which I think we heard discussed a bit during the Lianghui in the last couple of weeks, around how China is going to grip the challenge of reform and some of the difficult decisions that brings, social instability, unemployment, or whether they're going to continue with the temptation to pump infrastructure investment into the economy, duck the reform but keep the economy afloat, but kick the can of risk further down the road. So there are some real economic challenges there, which I think are important context. My own view is that the Chinese economy is now so big and so complex. Of course we need to talk about the big numbers, but the real answers lie in more detailed analysis of China's regions and various sectors of the economy. As Gordon Orr at McKinsey said in a rather good end-of-year piece, if you were in movies last year, you were doing very well. If you were in steel, you're doing pretty badly. So once you drill down into the detail, I think it's much easier to get a clearer picture of what's going on in the Chinese economy. But the economy, for me, is the second big theme that we need to watch when we talk about China. The third question that we need to watch, I think, when we talk about China is the sort of state of political reform and the internal political environment. I talked earlier about Xi Jinping having the strongest international presence of any previous president, but I think he also has more power as president than any previous president, possibly since Mao. His reforms in terms of driving through reform of the economy, society, the military, rule of law, anti-corruption reforms are very strong indeed. There's a strong sense now, I think, of centralization, which adds to the sense of Xi Jinping's power. I think some of that is very good. I think centralizing control of pensions, for example, will probably make sure the pension pot doesn't get out of control and destabilize society. I think centralizing, in some cases, energy policy should mean that we see less coal-fired power stations being built, which will stop, I hope, some of the pollution. But we have seen, as part of this, this power coming into the centre and constricting the space for free expression, free debate. So we saw several hundred lawyers last July arrested. Some of them were only charged in January, some of them still have not been charged. And I think there's a question there that if you constrain the space for free speech, free thinking, whether you constrain the space for innovation, which is what you need to drive forward a stable and dynamic economy. So those three big themes then, the international, the economic and the political, are the three themes or the backdrop against which we are looking at a UK-China golden era. So you'll remember last year, but let me just remind you of it in case it slipped your memory. So back in March, we had the Duke of Cambridge in China. That was the first royal visit in the direct line to the throne since the Queen had come in 1986. We ran through then, we launched the UK-China Year of Culture. We had our Festival of Creativity in Shanghai. We had high-level foreign policy talks with the Foreign Secretary and State Councillor Yang Jiechi. We had the Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, on a five-day, five-city tour in China. Vice Premier Liu Yandong came to the UK for what we call the people-to-people dialogue, which is a very simple umbrella for 10 very broad dialogues, which comprise important things like education, healthcare, sport, women, and things like that. And then, of course, we had President Xi Jinping's state visit in October. We declared that a golden year, and then we decided we'd have a golden era. Now, I absolutely recognise, as a historian, that normally a golden era is a retrospective epithet. So here we are at the beginning of a golden era, and it is very important, I think, for me and for all of us, that we do not, this is not just hot air, that this really has some substance. So what I wanted to share with you is the key elements that I think we want to make a success of in our golden era that will allow us further down the road to show that it really was a golden era. And there are five of these that I think embrace this new 21st century partnership that we've established with China. The first one is top-level exchanges. So in some ways, the very traditional part of diplomacy. The state visit was a very good example of that, and the Prime Minister will, of course, come to China for the G20 summit in September, and quite possibly again later in the year for a bilateral with Premier Li Keqiang. I've already had the Foreign Secretary in China in January, which coincided not only with the North Koreans letting off what they claimed was a hydrogen bomb, but also with the disappearance of the Hong Kong bookseller Li Bo. And that was a wonderful opportunity, quite by happenstance, for us to have very frank and very serious discussions with the Chinese about these issues of great concern. And I want to underline then what I mean by top-level exchanges is, sure, they're at the top level, but they really are exchanges. That's the value of them, and allow us to discuss major foreign policy issues, major issues between us. But those top-level exchanges, to be successful, need to be underpinned by a network of exchanges at working level, senior working level, expert level. And we have added to those some that we felt that where there were gaps. So, for example, on cybersecurity, we've added in new technical expert senior exchanges. On Afghanistan and South Asia, where we're working increasingly closely with the Chinese side, we've been able to add in dialogues to underpin these top-level exchanges. And the one that I'm really very interested in is quite innovative. We've now got exchanges between regional leaders. So we have just had a delegation of Chinese mayors and vice mayors over to the UK, mostly in the Northern Powerhouse, and they mostly come from the Yangtze River Economic Corridor. So building up high-level contacts between the regions of the UK and the regions of China, which I think will bring a huge dividend in the future. So that's the first pillar, as it were, of a golden era. The second pillar I don't think will surprise you at all, because it's about stimulating economic growth and jobs in both of our countries. Now, in the UK, we have made a lot in the last 5-10 years of the openness of our economy, its attractiveness to foreign investment, and we have benefited from a lot of Chinese investment over those years. Chinese foreign direct investment into the UK has grown by about 85% a year over the last 5 years. Most of you will know that during the state visit we agreed Chinese investment into Hinkley Point, into our civil nuclear capacity, although of course that's been slightly paused while EDF work out what they're going to do about the financing there. We've talked to the Chinese about investment into high-speed rail. So China has 18,000 kilometres of high-speed rail track. We're just looking at high-speed rail between London and Birmingham, but we very much hope that we can progress that, benefiting from investment from China. And most people know, of course, that we have the telecoms company Huawei here in the UK. That's their headquarters, and they have expanded from here into Europe. My point here is that this is not simply about China investing in retail, in property, or in things that people don't actually notice. I often talk about people who, you probably have to live in the southeast of England for this, but if you sort of get up in the southeast of England, take a shower, China has a stake in Southern Water. If you have Weetabix for breakfast, China has a stake in Weetabix. Probably the clothes that you're going to put on have got some sort of Chinese connection, and you can go through your day. Your mobile phone has probably got some sort of Chinese part in it. So there's already a lot of Chinese investment here, but we have opened up to Chinese investment in a very big way, and expect that more will come and support the restoration of infrastructure in particular in the UK. What of course we'd like to see during the golden era is reciprocity, because China is still more closed to foreign investment than the UK is. So in particular in services, the Chinese market remains remarkably closed, and we'd like to see that open up. There are particular barriers to trade that I think it would help our exporters if we could remove them. So some of those around food are particularly well known. We recently managed to remove the barriers on pig's trotters, which are very important and a great delicacy in China, so worth more than you might think. But broadly, we'd like to see more exchanges around the big themes of the 13th five-year plan, which has just been agreed. So around greening, innovation, urbanisation, where the UK has a lot of expertise, and China has been doing some very interesting pioneering work. So there's a lot there where we can continue to work, where our global economies, our, both of our economies, overlap. So that's the second pillar of the of the golden era that I wanted to talk about. I think I'd add just a couple of things to that. I've talked a bit about mapping our regional initiatives, and I was in Bristol yesterday, and the mayor of Bristol was talking about having a western powerhouse now to match the northern powerhouse as a way of framing an investment and an export offer to Chinese companies, and I think that's a very good idea as well. And of course this year in particular we have an opportunity to work with China in international organisations, and we are co-chairing the Green Finance Group and the Anti-Corruption Working Group as we lead into the G20 summit in September. And then the third area that I think will be key to a successful golden era is going to be our cooperation in international affairs. We've already worked very closely with China. Of course, we're both permanent members of the UN Security Council. We're both in the G20, and we've had strong foreign policy ties for a long while. But I think it's plausible to argue now that some of the challenges of the 21st century require a new approach. So, of course, we'll continue to work closely in geographical areas, so we can look more at working in Africa. We partnered China quite closely in trying to combat Ebola in West Africa in the last year or so. And our new work that we have launched with China is around, of course, AMR, antimicrobial resistance, where we could face nearly a million people dying unnecessarily from drug resistance to infections, and we've set up a joint research and innovation fund with China in this area. So these sort of 21st century areas of foreign policy that transcend national boundaries, I think, will be a very important and fruitful source of collaboration. Climate change, following up on the Paris conference last year, would be another one that I would cite. Now, it's not all straightforward. I'm not going to pretend it is. Some foreign policy problems are very intractable. I would say ISIL and Daesh was one of those, and we were delighted that we got a joint statement with China during the Foreign Secretary's visit on Syria. But things like the South China Sea, the East China Sea, are also much more complicated. The key thing is, I think, that it's not that we have been able to solve them, but the key is that in having the levels of talks that we have, we are committed to the dialogue that will allow us to manage and solve those problems ultimately, and ultimately committed to a rules-based international order, and that rules-based international order which adjusts to the realities of the 21st century, as we saw with the IMF voting rights at the end of last year, but also holds to the standards and the values that keep it robust and valuable for all of us. That's the international piece. A couple more areas that I think are important. The area that I think of, I have to say very warmly, as the next generation, which is many of you, to be honest. It's about the people-to-people exchanges, because these are the exchanges that will underpin, as I said earlier, any bilateral relationship and give it a future and strength into the next decades. It's things, obviously, like education, and I pay particular tribute to Professor Cox, because he referenced our meeting at the LSE Baidar Summer School and the academic direction that he's given now in its 13th year for that fantastic programme is just one example of the very many rich and fruitful exchanges between the UK and China in the education sphere. We now have more than 250 joint university programmes between the UK and China and a number of joint campuses. And I think the next step somehow is to take those and shape an educational offering that allows our young people to benefit from the very best of Western, UK and Chinese educational traditions, which is exactly what these programmes are doing, because that's the best way of preparing for the 21st century. So education is a very important theme of the next generation. Tourism. We saw over 500,000 UK visitors go to China last year, mainland China, another 500,000 go to Hong Kong alone. And we have seen around 400,000 tourist visas issued to Chinese people to come to the UK. We've now got, of course, our two-year multiple entry visa offer, which was intended to encourage tourism, and the prospect of moving to a 10-year multiple entry visa as soon as we can get the technology and the agreement to make it reciprocal sorted out. So tourism exchanges will be, I think, very important. And that sort of brings me very neatly into the cultural exchanges piece. We're having a very exciting time this year with Shakespeare, who got mentioned in the title. So it's the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death, for anyone who hasn't picked that up. And we have a huge programme across China with plays and films and talks and online activity, highlighting the extraordinary contribution Shakespeare has made to drama, culture, understanding of humanity, the English language. And of course that is coincidentally linked with the 400th anniversary of the death of the Chinese playwright Tang Jianju. So we've got some joint activities going on there. We've already reached 300 million people with the launch of that programme, and just in the last month 10,000 people saw the Royal Shakespeare Company's production of Henry V. So I think we are bringing Shakespeare to China in a big way. But if Shakespeare's not your piece, then I should confess that yesterday when I was down in Bristol, I went to Aardman and saw Shaun the Sheep, who was the big hit of last year in China, hugely popular, and of course doesn't require any understanding of language. And they, Aardman, have got some very exciting proposals to follow that up in China. Sherlock, hugely popular. And just to prove that not everything begins with S, Downton Abbey is, of course, just as popular. So there's a big cultural piece that joins us up, and I think will help inform the next generation. So there's a really important piece there. Finally, a slightly more challenging area. We have rule of law down as the fifth area. And we talked about this, to be very frank, for a long while. Whether this should be a separate category or whether, frankly, the rule of law should be embedded and flowing through everything we did. Because obviously the rule of law flows through the rules-based international order. It obviously flows through business. You've got protection of intellectual property. You've got contract law. But you've also got the rule of law in society. And for that reason, we actually separated it out, because it's been such a priority for President Xi Jinping, a very clear commitment to be ruling China in accordance with the law and the constitution by 2020. And we also felt that it was truly the foundation for an open, fair, stable and prosperous society, access to justice that should be fair and transparent. And I think the NPC agreed an ambitious programme of legal reform at the Lianhui in the last couple of weeks. So more work on courts, professional standards, public understanding of law and participation in the law, which is all very important. And we've agreed to continue our exchanges in this area, because I think it will be valuable for us and also for China to make progress in this area that Xi Jinping has identified as a priority. Now, I don't want to pretend that this is all risk-free. If bilateral relations was not risk-free, we wouldn't have senior ambassadors, I wouldn't have anything to do, and to be very blunt about it, probably wouldn't have such large military either. But let me, if I may, make a point through a slightly flippant analogy. If you were to Google China crisis, you actually get a British band, a rock band that was formed in 1979 near Liverpool, for those of you who are at all interested in British pop music. And the thing I like about China Crisis, the band, is that they sort of enjoyed moderate success through the 1980s, you know, top 40 singles, top 40 albums. They went international in the 1990s and brought out a new album in 2014. How's that? And even in November 2015, we get a compilation album. Now, that's a slightly flippant point, or a flippant way of making the point that the China crisis narrative, which is the sort of risk that underpins a lot of this, has been prevalent pretty much since the beginning of the reform and opening up programme. So the reform, of course, it has carried risks, but what I don't want us to do is to get carried away by this China crisis narrative, because, of course, there are problems in society and in the economy in China, but as the longevity of the China crisis band shows us, this is a narrative, it's a leitmotif, it's a risk that we need to manage rather than be entirely derailed by. So I entirely acknowledge that this year we've seen serious market volatility in the Chinese stock market and in the currency. We continue to have challenges around intellectual property. We've seen worrying developments in China in society. So the people, as I mentioned, the lawyers who were arrested back in last July, many of them have not yet been charged, and those that have are less convincing. We saw the disappearance of the Hong Kong bookseller, Li Bo, and we've seen incursions into the South China Seas, which are currently uncertain for all of us in an area that is very important for free shipping. So this is not, it is not risk-free, it's not plain sailing, building a golden era in a relationship between the UK and China. And when we signed up for the AIIB last year, there was some eyebrow raising from some of our international partners, and I'm sure we can talk about that in a bit. But let me say, by way of conclusion, the Prime Minister, David Cameron, said, China's rise is one of the defining facts of our lifetime. You can see the opportunity or the threat, but you can't ignore it. And so what we're doing in the British government is taking the opportunity to engage and to deepen our global partnership in many ways, and in many ways that are outside, I think, traditional diplomacy. So we're pushing out the frontier, I would argue, of diplomacy. I think we do have much to gain if we get it right. I think China too has much to gain from this golden era, and they too are using exactly the same phrase. When I go around China, I hear that very regularly. So I think both countries have a lot to do working together. We have a strong foundation to build on, and we have huge excitement because now the relationship and international diplomacy, as I said in the title, embraces stocks, Shakespeare and satellites. And I'll stop there. I'm very interested to hear your comments and questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Great.